accustomed to arguing with emperors, deposed or otherwise, I still replied, "With respect, I was merely using that as an example. Their odd vision can be used against them. Surely there are other ways of befuddling them, confusing them, at least briefly, so as to seize an advantage." Sinead looked at Darzac and Latvedica. "Peculiar vision that is not vision. Well, that is something we will need to consider tactically at length, pending the Grand Myrmidon's tacit approval, of course." She barely hid a scowl as she said, "What else?" "Well," I replied, "as I said, they do not see colors at all. You could choose to fight them in some tall grass, arrive the night before, and paint areas ahead of time that are filled with caltrops, for instance. Your men would know which areas to avoid, but the deserters could never see the paint or whitewash." Muldus grinned or snarled. It was hard to say with the left side of his lips still not cooperating fully.
"More devious every day, Scribbler. I like it."
He looked at Latvedica.
"Another weakness. Big bastards don't use shields that we saw. Not any. They got brass and leather armor and skin as thick as Aruda's, but the fuckers are susceptible to arrows and bolts."
Darzac tapped his sword hilt. "So back to the numbers game. We strike from range and take them out before they even get close." Braelar said, "Bear in mind, they have staff slings. With the deserter's size and strength and the length of the weapon, the slings are essentially siege engines. They can launch rocks or lead shot the size of your fist from a greater distance than we can shoot our bows."
"Fair enough," the commander said. "They strike first. But I'm guessing not all their 30,000 have slings. We get within our range, we will have numbers again. Can mow the big bastards down."
Muldus replied, "Stands to reason, Commander. Only these huge Rudicunts got their own tricks. Besides big plaguing stones and lead, the staffers shoot pods at the onset, release a hellish smoke that brings visibility to zero and leaves you sputtering and hacking. We engaged them with crossbow cavalry just on the other side of the veil, thinking we could just peg them to pieces from range. But they disabused us of that notion right quick."
"And what's more," Braelar added, "as the lieutenant said, they have armor of brass plates and ruder hide, and skin 10 times as thick as our own. Beyond their obvious size and strength advantage, the reason they can take out so many men before falling is that they can absorb a tremendous amount of punishment. The ones we killed with crossbows looked like hedgehogs."
Softune said, "And let us not forget the wielders. We fought them when they only had one or two, and we were soundly trounced. With such a sizable force, the deserters undoubtedly brought more than one or two to this side. We will have to contend with them."
Vinduro jerked a thumb towards Nastenzia.
"But we stole one of their foci. That ought to help you Myrmidons take out some wielders, or counter them, or whatever."
Nastenzia replied,
"You forget, Sildoon, I am but one of many. The matriarch will be here with her full contingent of wielders and foci."
"Huh,"
Vinduro said.
"Ah, yep, that's bad,"
Braelar said. "And precisely why we need to explore all the ways we can take advantage of the few weaknesses the deserters do have, and begin making preparations immediately. We have many weaknesses, but time is chief among them."
Latvedica said, "Then let us conclude this clandestine meeting and return to the capital to continue discussions of strategy."
Braelar Twitch smiled. "You will forgive me, Grand Myrmidon, if I do not accept your exceptionally gracious offer. We will continue discussions here about tactics and terrain and what affords us the greatest chance of achieving victory. And my company will remain outside the walls until the jackals and other towers march forth to engage the deserters."
He looked at me.
"Okay. Let the others know we will be rejoining our jackal brethren soon enough." I nodded and turned to go and heard Muldus add,
"Might leave off the bit about us marching off to do battle with a huge host of deserters to save a plaguing empire. Leave that message to Cap. He'll deliver it so it sounds like we'll be toasting our victory over Vrilinka's corpse before the day is done."
Chapter 49. After we met with the Myrmidons in the abandoned mine, they returned to the capital, and we remained in the hills,
2 days later, we rode down before dawn and waited outside Sunrak for the bridges to roll out and the gates to open. The Merlins on top of the towers caught the first rays of light first. Their fanciful and stylized representations of the various charges on display. Foxes and moons, pikes and beetles, elk and horses. Having entered and left the city under the cover of night the last two times, I had forgotten just how impressive it was. But as the gates opened and the lines of soldiers started to ride out, I realized that I didn't really know what impressive was. Before riding with the Sildoon, I'd seen only fisticuffs or the odd knife fight in a tavern. But since joining Braelar, I'd witnessed intense combat in a wagon, bloody skirmishes in ruins and deserted streets, melees in the woods and the fringes of a town, larger battles between the jackals and both Imperials and deserters. None of that prepared me for the spectacle of seeing the full might of the Sildoon Empire assembling on the broad plain around Sunrak. Even though I expected a massive army was going to file out of the largest city I'd ever seen, knowing it is going to happen, and making your eyes accept it, are two totally different things. I was on horseback with the rest of Braelar's small company as the Elk Tower filed out of Sunrak first, all mounted, even the infantry, their banners snapping in the morning breeze. As they left the bridge, they began forming up into columns 50 men wide and 20 deep. Even working with haste, it took time to assume their formations and continue making room for the next column, and the next, and all the ones after. Vindiro was watching me watch and laughed.
Something else, ain't it? Seeing a tower ride out in force?
I nodded, counting soldiers, calculating, in awe, at the precision they managed even with their ranks filling out more by the minute. Rudgie was alongside us and said,
That's nothing. This is a smallish tower. Just wait, Aki. You're in for a real treat today. The Empire hasn't sent out an army this size in 100 years, maybe more.
With the sun cascading golden down the hillside, only a few wispy clouds above, and the tower forming up as if on parade, it was easy to forget that we were all riding to face the greatest threat the Empire had ever seen. I would have been happier if storm clouds were on the horizon, as those would have at least favored us. But Rudgie wasn't wrong. More and more towers rode out of the four bridges of Sunrak as the day wore on, forming up, their supply wagons with weapons and provisions and pavilions and who knew what else rolling up at the rear. The plain filled up quickly, and it was truly a spectacle unlike anything I'd ever seen. As the smaller towers, relatively speaking, the otters looked to be just shy of 3,000, the hawks around 5, but both still far larger than any force I'd ever seen outside of an illuminated manuscript, gave way to the middle-sized ones, such as the foxes, ravens, and jackals. I assumed the leopards and a few of the largest would be coming sometime later, but we were done watching. Our small company rode down, passed under the aqueduct we knew all too well, and filed in with one of the lead columns of the jackals. Commander Darzak was at the fore, looking grim and determined as ever, and the captain and his officers saluted him. Sofchian and a handful of other Myrmidons were now a close and permanent part of his retinue, making sure their presence and control was felt. That must have galled the old man fiercely, and the other commanders as well, but as Braelar noted at the mines, the Sildoon loyalty, unbending to their own tower, was very malleable when it came to pledging fealty to the power of the day. Some towers had likely already sworn allegiance to the Myrmidon rule, and even meant it. Still, I didn't imagine Commander Darzak was going to be one of those, assuming he lived, or that any of us did. Part of me feared Braelar would leave me behind with the supply wagons, and part of me hoped he might. That must have registered on my face as Vindiro leaned over and said,
You ride with us until we get close, a few days or so, then you hang back with the commander's column. Safest place for you, really. Just stay close to Commander Darzak. Cap and the rest of us, we'll be ahead, skirmishing and harrying the big bastards. But you'll be good back there.
Muldus overheard and said,
Don't coddle him, Ven, for plague's sake.
He leaned out of his saddle and jabbed a finger in my chest, and I was thankful I had the gambeson on.
Listen here, Scribbler. After we engage, there won't be a safe place. Jackals will be in the center, and right up front. And this is a plaguing deserter army we're talking about. Not trying to make you shit yourself, but don't go into this thinking you'll be out there picking flowers or counting clouds either. Could be, after we piss the huge bastards off and ride back, Cap'll want you with us. If we dismount anyway, you can't ride for shit. Could be, though, he'll order you to stay with the commander. Either way, you'll probably need to use that crossbow and sword before the day is done. Do what I trained you to do, and you have a halfway decent chance of not dying immediately.
As inspiring and encouraging as ever. With several towers ahead of us, the next 3 days involved a lot of eating dust and looking around repeatedly, marveling at the sheer size of the army as we made slow but steady progress through the hilly country between Sunrag and Greymoss. One thing that became immediately apparent was that the romances and manuscript pages were completely inadequate in capturing the immense smells that accompanied a huge host on the move. The wafting stench of sweaty humanity, the multitude of horses, shit from both creatures, meat sizzling on spits, oil from the wagons, it was nearly overpowering at first. So too the endless sounds of harness and armor jingling, wagon axles creaking, horses whinnying, men shouting orders up and down the lines, or calling for Sildoon slave boys and girls who hadn't undergone the manumission ceremony to attend them or fetch this or that. And in the divisions of every tower where the commanders and officers rode, there were always the Myrmidons, silent, watching, alert. Some that were surely war Myrmidons, and some with more subtle skills like Skillana, silently communicating with their sisters. We weren't going to be on a prolonged campaign, which I was grateful for, but the number of supply wagons was also staggering, most laden with food and weapons, but some with the pavilions for the commanders and smaller tents for their officers. For the rest of us, it was fairly simple. After horses were picketed, patrols and scouts sent out to roam the countryside far ahead, and guards posted, the nights meant a restless sleep in a bedroll on the hard, cold ground. And for me anyway, a growing dread about the battle looming ahead, and a morbid curiosity about whether the deserters had finished executing the inhabitants of Erstbright with their veil dome. Rudgie joined me for a few hours on the second night, snuggling up against my body and falling asleep almost immediately. Exhausted from scouting, she had no interest in coupling, but the closeness of her body was a greater comfort than I imagined. She was gone before I woke up, and I might have thought I dreamed it, except her smell was still there with me. The fourth day, we entered a broad, shallow valley that sloped down below us, with the highest hills to the east and west. The ground was largely brown and tan, with a patchwork of green scrub here and there, and some short, stiff, and apparently stubborn grass growing in long, winding swaths, with a stunning array of purple flowers hugging the hills to the west. But what really stood out, and had to be the reason the army halted its march, with orders being shouted and conveyed again and again like an echo, was the pattern of glaring rectangles of white across the middle of the valley floor, the whitewash practically glowing in the sun, the rectangles marking the place no man or horse should go. They took my suggestion to heart. And then it hit me. This was where we were going to make our stand. The army spread out across our side of the valley, the towers maintaining integrity as they moved down to slightly more level ground, operating independently under the orders of their respective commanders, but obviously connected by the Myrmidons accompanying them, relaying silent communications across the valley to coordinate effectively and precisely. We had to be thousands of yards across, and several hundred yards deep. The Jackals were positioning themselves roughly in the middle of the center divisions of troops, composed primarily of heavy infantry, who would dismount and take up their long spears and composite bows when battle was imminent. Commander Darzak and his officers and a small block of troops took up position behind the front divisions. I assumed because it afforded a better view, with somewhat better elevation, though the incline was still very gradual on this end of the valley. The other tower commanders did the same, to better communicate orders. Far off to our west, the horse tower in their thousands had their armored cavalry as one wing along the bottom of a fairly steep incline at the base of the hills there. I looked to the east, the brim of my kettle hat providing good shade, and there was another wing far to the east, likely also cavalry, though I couldn't make out the tower that settled into that spot. There were hills there as well, beyond the right wing, but more gradual. Glancing to our rear, I saw the other towers moving about, keeping their cohesion, ready to deploy their infantry, and behind those, the auxiliaries and supply wagons. It truly was a staggering sight. I stopped moving, and another jackal shouted at me. I apologized, nudging my horse along with my knees, and some less hostile words of encouragement. Vindura was nearby and rode over. I looked around as roughly 200,000 Sildoon and Memmerdons slowly overtook the southern expanse of the valley. "So," I said, "this is it then?" He nodded, grinning.
"Oh, yep. Good a place as any, am I right?"
I forced a nod, but coughed on some dust, so as spare trying to look overly brave or confident. He had enough for the both of us.
"Kind of glad the giant bastards showed their ugly faces on this side. They killed off plenty of jackals over there, so there'd be some revenging in store just on that account. But wiping out two whole cities? They owe us more blood than they can ever repay. Once we litter this valley with their corpses, I hope Cap leads an expedition across the Godvale again, so we can kill every last one of the hulking whore sons."
I glanced around again, at the lines of soldiers spreading out, reforming, the largest host assembled in living memory and beyond. But almost none of them knew what really was heading this way. No matter how they were briefed, or what the commanders and Memmerdons actually revealed, I hoped they weren't overconfident in their advantage of numbers. Numbers alone would not destroy this enemy. But they couldn't possibly understand that before fighting them.
"How's that for timing?"
Vindoro pointed at tower slaves moving among the ranks, handing out scarves. Every soldier took one and tied it around his or her neck. I accepted mine and asked, "What is this?"
"Might only help a little, but Cap thought it would be good to have something to keep from choking to death if the deserted whore sons launch those smoke gores at us again. Speaking of,"
and he popped the last bit of egg in his mouth as Braylor and Muldus rode up, their faces obscured by the Aventail drapes on their helms. The captain said, "Lieutenant, it is time we reintroduce ourselves to the deserters and show Matriarch Vrilinka some of our hospitality." He pointed to the sky. "It is an exceptionally fine day for crossbows."
"Aye,"
Vindoro said, dusting his hands off on his pants and turning his horse about.
"That it is."
He tapped the brim of his own helm and said,
"Be seeing you, Aki."
Whatever words I might have chosen dried up in my mouth, so I only nodded as they rode off towards a division of crossbow cavalry that dwarfed the force the captain had led when we fled Sunrak the first time after Skalana's betrayal. There had to have been at least 1,000 jackals, and further up the line, another division led by another captain was forming up as well. Both groups rode away from our line towards the north part of the valley. I watched as they carefully trotted around the squares of earth and grass ahead that had been painted white, taking the alleys between. I wondered if they were littered with caltrops. The day was warm, but not especially hot, and still the sweat began to pour in earnest as I watched the jackals disappear over the slight ridge at the other end of the valley. Chapter 50. The next 2 hours crept by with excruciating slowness. I kept scanning the other end of the valley, hoping to see the captain and his men return. But as it turned out, the only arrival was from the rear. The Urglovian Sildoon had sent a large contingent of war wagons to join us, and they slowly made their way to the center to help anchor it against whatever deserter onslaught came. They set up at least 80 war wagons there, just ahead of the jackals, alongside Sinead's considerable tower forces. Like all Sildoon, they knew their business and worked methodically. I watched for hours as they lined war wagons up, chained them end to end, arranged the wooden walls, set up ballistae on the wagon beds, and handed out the glaives, halberds, long spears, and extra sheaves of arrows for the composite bows as soldiers took up their positions. But after that distraction passed, I again had to suffer my thoughts in fear. Rudgie was off scouting. Braylar and his retinue were skirmishing with a deserter host and trying to draw them here. And while I was standing in the middle of a huge Sildoonian and Memmerdon army,
I felt more alone than I had in a long time. Even when I saw the wounded hornman at the great fair in Aelspell, it had only been me wandering for a bit, trying to clear my head. But now, for the first time since joining the captain and his company, anyone I'd known for more than a few minutes was either dead, or could be. Almost everyone. I heard her voice coming from a few feet behind me.
"I'm a bit surprised to see you here, young scholar. At this point, perhaps I shouldn't be. You do seem to have a habit of courting danger."
"Or," I said, not turning around, "danger just has a way of finding me." She moved up alongside me, and also looked across the scrubby floor of the shallow valley towards the other side.
"Are you concerned for the well-being of my brother?"
"You look concerned." It was said in such a way that I couldn't determine if she was earnest or simply trying to needle me, so I didn't reply.
"You shouldn't be worried," Sofjian said. "He is exceptionally gifted at taking care of himself."
There it was. While I knew all too well what she was capable of, and she still made me very uneasy, I no longer quavered in her presence, and her demeanor actually irritated me enough that I replied, "It must have been satisfying." She looked at me, eyebrows raised ever so slightly. "To strike down Thamar like that," I said. Sofjian didn't change her expression, stance, or tone, which was more than irritating. "It was necessary. I didn't take pleasure in doing it, but neither did it offend any sensibilities."
And that surprises me a little. I mean, regardless of what hatred you harbor for your brother, or whatever culpability you think he had, Thumar was ultimately responsible for ordering the decimation and enslavement of your people. So, having the chance to not only completely thwart him, but to actually be the one to strike him dead, I'm surprised it didn't bring you greater satisfaction.
She spun her rancor in the dirt, the tassels whipping around like a dancer's skirts.
"By that token, you must have found it satisfying to see Skalana killed."
I considered a few different responses, and opted for the truth. I was the one who dealt the blow that finally killed her, and I hoped it would make me feel a great deal better than it did. She was probably going to die either way, and I could have left her to it, but I chose not to.
"Mercy," she said, rather neutrally.
"No," I replied, "not especially. I just didn't want to hear her talk anymore." Sofjian laughed, short and clipped.
"You have a terrible sense of humor," I said.
She replied, "I'm sorry, it's just a bit ironic is all. I was just thinking that while killing Thumar felt a bit empty, perhaps it was because I really wanted him to know what it meant to me personally. I didn't have the time to explain. It wasn't just part of a political maneuver, or simply the transaction of another coup, but some vengeance I'd held on to for so many years, it putrefied." Sofjian favored me with a smile that didn't seem envenomed, predatory, or a disguise for calculations.
"So, it struck me as funny. I wanted more time, to draw out Thumar's suffering, to express why I did so, to convey something to the man as he writhed in pain, and was just thinking that it never works out that way. There is never enough time, and we don't often get to the words we most want to say, whereas you just wanted Skilana to stop talking."
I found myself smiling in return. "Well, we were in a bit of a hurry." I didn't admit that I really didn't want Skilana suffering anymore, even if part of me felt like she deserved it. Sofjian returned her attention to the opposite ridge of the valley. I did as well. We were both quiet until I said, "May I ask you something else?" Sofjian said, "That depends. May I kill you for talking too much?" I replied, "Well, you did approach me after all."
"Point taken. What is it you wanted to know?"
I looked around at the endless soldiers everywhere, walking, lounging, napping, playing dice, arguing, looking off in the valley exactly as we were. Nearly 200,000 of them, with Myrmidons mixed in their midst everywhere. That would be enough. It had to be. I thought about dropping it, but then decided that with Doom very possibly marching towards our position, getting husked by a Memrodon might not be the worst thing that could happen. You used us to break Sinead's hold on the Memrodons. Do you think it's possible, when Vrilinka and her wielders examined us, that they sensed what you planned, and wanted it to succeed, to pave the way for their own invasion? They didn't pursue us the way I expected. Maybe they allowed us to return for a reason. Sofjin didn't reply right away, and I feared I had misstepped. But then she ground the ransom in the earth. Latvedica and my other sisters, they have asked me the same thing. At length, in light of recent events, I will answer you as I did them. Yes, it is entirely possible the deserters were hoping the Memrodon coup would succeed. But also, it's immaterial. We are not about to rebind ourselves to the Sildune commanders. And the deserters are here. They have attacked us. And we must eradicate them all, or at least defeat them decisively, to send a message to any of Vrilinka's kind that they must never venture on this side again, or at least not for another millennium. That is all that matters just now. And if... She stopped as I pointed to the other end of Valley, as the first horseman began to gallop over. I said, "It looks like we will have our chance soon." "That it does, Arki. That it does. Come, let's join the commander." After the crossbow cavalry avoided the gleaming white patches of grass and what appeared to be dirt in the valley, I tried to calculate their numbers. But they weren't in as tight a formation as the infantry, and moving fast besides. Still, it was obvious they had suffered some casualties, as the unit could not have been the size it was when they left. Most of the mounted jackals then veered off and rode to join the left wing of Sildune cavalry, while Braelar and his officers made for our position. After riding through the ranks of infantry ahead of us, they dismounted near Commander Darzak, his other officers, and the handful of Memrodons, and I was relieved to see that Braelar and his retinue were all still alive. After the jackals saluted, Commander Darzak barked,
"Report, Captain!"
Braelar pulled his helm and avental off, his face red and sweaty.
"As our scouts indicated, the deserters are indeed ahead of us and heading south, and as we expected, they had their own advance party, a few hundred as it were. We harassed them, exchanged some volleys, maintained our distance, but did not engage directly."
Darzak scratched the white stubble on his face around the prominent sideburns.
"These eyes aren't what they were, but looks like you lost some men."
"Aye," the captain replied. "Only a few injuries in the first exchanges, but we harried their scouts as they made their way back towards the main host. And that's when another party came out of a nearby ravine, flanked us, and hit us hard. Only this one had a wielder."
He looked at Sofjin. "And you know just how devastating those are." He turned back to the commander and said,
"We managed to take her out, as well as half that scouting party, but we lost close to 200 men fighting through them. As I said, our numerical superiority is not so superior as all that."
Darzak's face grew more splotchy the angrier he got.
"We best hope that sacrifice was worth it, and they follow you this way. We won't get a chance to set up in another valley."
Braelar accepted a proffered costrel of water from a soldier, as Muldus replied,
"We nipped at their heels and pissed them off pretty good. The only upside to getting slaughtered so fast is we probably gave the giant horse cunts all the encouragement they plaguing need. They'll come."
"They better."
Darzak looked at Sofjin and another pastier-looking Memrodon who wasn't kitted out for combat.
"Best let your sisters know. Relay the word."
The doughy Memrodon pursed her lips but nodded as Sofjin said,
"A most excellent suggestion. You do recall, however, that you were offering us your suggestions and military expertise, but not orders, Commander. Not ever again."
The commander flushed nearly purple and looked ready to chew rocks into pebbles. His jaws were grinding so hard.
"Aye, Memrodon. I'm not quite as sharp as that Sinead, though. I'll probably need to hear it a few more times before it sinks in."
Sofjin said, "Who better to remind than one with exemplary memory?"
"Quite," the commander replied,
the word nothing but gravel. The pasty Myrmidon moved away from the Sildoon officers and then stood still, eyes closed, no doubt relaying a message coded in memories to her sisters with the other towers. Braelar asked Darzak,
"When the deserters arrive, do you want me to lead the crossbow cavalry on the wing, Commander?"
Darzak replied,
"Aye, you and Lieutenant Muldus there, Sergeant Bresnik as well. Anyone else you need, the rest can stay with me."
"As you say, Commander."
Darzak looked at the much younger captain, rolled his shoulders back in his lamellar cuirass, and said,
"It's good to have you back with us, Kilcoyne. Didn't really have an opportunity to say as much before."
The captain nodded.
"It is good to be back, Commander."
Some younger Sildoon slaves came up to Braelar and his officers to lead the horses back to a small picket behind the jackal column. One of them, a stocky lad who must have been nearing his manumission, reached to take Scorn's bridle. Braelar said,
"Do take care. She is notoriously ill-tempered. Assuming you ingratiate yourself and she does not bite your face off, you will need to rub her down properly. She has ridden hard the last 2 days."
The Sildoon slave blanched a bit and said,
"Aye, Captain,"
as he cautiously led Scorn away, looking at the beast as if it were a ripper rather than a horse. I asked Braelar, "Is that something you tell grooms to keep them in line, or is she truly as vicious as all that?" He looked at me.
"Worse, in fact. Scorn bit a stable boy's ear clean off not long before we met. She is aptly named, Arky."
And well suited to her master, I thought, but did not say. I had grown comfortable in the captain's presence, but not that comfortable. Up and down the lines all around and in front of us, the infantry put their embattled long shields and long spears on the earth at their feet near the extra sheaves of arrows and had their composite bows out. I saw the ballistae operators on the war wagons in the front begin to crank their windlasses to draw the wooden trough back, the large iron-tipped arrows the size of small spears being slotted in place. As it turned out, the anxiety and preparation were premature. It was dawn the following day before Reggie and some scouts returned to rouse the army and announce the approach of the deserter army.
Chapter 51. The deserter scouts stood tall on the horizon of the valley, massive silhouettes, even from thousands of yards away. The morning sun lit their white skin, winked on the brass plates on their hardened ruder hide armor, and flitted across those strange spikes in their great clubs. I was with Braelar and his retinue alongside the commander, and there were a number of curses, exclamations, and even gasps as jackals saw the massive eyeless enemy for the first time. More and more of the deserters crossed the ridge, and it looked like some were gesturing in our direction. Realizing the giants could inexplicably see with no organs to do so, had some Sildoon uttering louder curses, and more than one, "Plague me." The commander put his hands up to his mouth and called out,
"Listen here, jackals. This is your commander speaking. The deserters might be big and freakish, but our own Captain Kilcoyne and his boys have killed them by the score. The giants bleed. The giants die. And we're here to be sure they do both. Now quit your jabbering, steel yourselves, and do your plaguing duty, or by gods, the deserters will be the least of your worries."
In the romances, and even some of the histories, there were accounts of stirring and even lyrical speeches preceding battles, instilling courage and resolve. But that was the extent of Darzak's. Still, it had the desired effect. The soldiers in the ranks around us shut their mouths. It looked like other commanders were taking the same tack, with Sinead being the most demonstrative, resplendent in his jet and gold enameled scale cuirass, the horsehair plume waving in the breeze as he rode his stallion back and forth in front of the leopard divisions. Latvetica was one of his Myrmidon keepers, and looked on sourly as he made his showy speech that I wasn't close enough to make out. Reggie was nearby and said,
"Gods, what a pompous ass he is. Bet Sinead wishes the deserters actually were plaguing gods. More glory in the victory."
I had my crossbow in hand and was chewing on my lower lip, near to eating it as I watched half the deserter scouting party come down the incline on the opposite end of the valley, while the remainder returned to report. Venduro said,
"Easy there, Aki. It will be a spell yet. The huge horse sons aren't going to come screaming over the ridge and running into our spears just yet. They got to be a way out yet, and once they do show, stands to reason they got to assemble."
I forced myself to try to breathe more slowly as I looked up at the sky. It was a perfectly cloudless day, the azure above almost brilliant in its purity. I have to admit, I was hoping for a spot of rain.
"Me too," Venduro said. "Or at least some shade. It's going to get warm today. Little rain would sure feel good."
Reggie said,
"I have to hand it to you, Lieutenant. Never seen a man more worried about creature comforts, no matter what the conditions."
Venduro replied,
"Well, I'm a creature, and I like to be comfortable. If my basic needs ain't met, I tend to get cranky. At least there's time to break off fast. That's something."
We watched along with the rest of the assembled Sildoon army as Venduro proved prophetic. The main force of the deserters showed up mid-morning, walking over the ridge and down the slight hill. And it was midday by the time their whole host was there, with the rooters pulling their colossal wagons behind them. The deserters formed a long line across the floor of the opposite end of the valley, several ranks deep, with the staff slingers mostly on the wings. I asked, "Why aren't they in a block, or other formations like the Sildoon?"
Venduro replied, "Them not being Sildoon, can't say for certain. But it's actually smart. They probably imagine we'll try to flank them at some point, given how we got the numbers. A long line makes that tougher."
With the sun glinting off the brass plates on the hulking warriors, and the female deserters being shorter and much thinner, it wasn't difficult to make out the wielders in their ranks. And with an army of more than 30,000, it wasn't surprising that that included hundreds of wielders. We had numbers, but as the captain said, that guaranteed nothing at all today. The ballistae were prepped and loaded, the more than 150,000 infantry had their bows ready, and with any luck, the deserters would fall prey to whatever traps the Sildoon had prepared. We were fighting them on ground of our choosing. We were as prepared as we could be. We had a huge numerical advantage. And yet my heart felt like it might burst through my ribcage and fly free like a bloody hawk at any moment.
"What if they wait until dark?" I asked. "Wouldn't that be smart as well, given that they can sense us, but we will be the blind ones?"
Sofjin walked up unnoticed, as she was so talented at doing.
"That would be problematic, it is true, but we anticipated as much, and brought thousands of lanterns and torches. You can be sure every one of them will be lit if the deserters hold for nightfall."
"Not ideal," Venduro said. "But then, neither is fighting giants at all, really. We'll do what needs doing."
But then the line of deserters started to slowly advance across the valley, the warriors and wielders, as well as the rooters pulling the wagons.
"Hmm," Sofjian said. "Strange. I actually assumed they would wait."
Reggie replied,
"Are they worried about being penned in? Is there another Sildoon force riding from the provinces?"
"An astute question."
"There is, in fact, another force coming," Sofjian replied. "But it is several days out yet. And even if their scouts sighted that army, it is considerably smaller than the one in front of them, and not likely to startle them into acting rashly."
Venduro said,
"Anvil's a lot bigger than the hammer, but the hammer does the pounding. Maybe they did a forced march and are coming in from the rear. Like you said, the smart play would be to wait for dark. But here they come."
Witnessing a huge force of deserters marching across a valley towards us was more terrifying than I imagined. Perhaps it was good there were only a few handfuls of us in this host who had seen what the giants were capable of. With their huge legs and long strides, it didn't take them long to cross half the valley. When they were still more than 600 yards out, the line stopped. Some deserters moved among the human slaves that were helping drive the wagons, and I wondered if Bolto were still alive, And if so, if he was hoping his masters might be destroyed, or we might, for breaking our promise and leaving him behind. The deserters were unloading something, though we didn't have enough elevation to make out what it was. Reggie said, "What do you suppose?" But the answer revealed itself before the question was done. The deserters were passing out huge rectangular sections of wood that were bigger than barn doors, like massive sections of palisade walls, and twice as thick from the looks of it. The warriors slung their great clubs and staff slings on their backs, hefted the huge panels, and then positioned them so the edges overlapped as they created a wall as well as a roof for the entire line.
"Plague me," Vindero said, "but that's clever. They know how many bows we got on this side, just aching to use them. But that there is better than any shield wall. We were hoping to shoot them to pieces, but guessing we could loose 100 million arrows now, and it wouldn't make a difference. Plaguing clever bastards."
The line started to move forward again, leaving the wagons behind, progressing more slowly, but inexorably, towards us. When they were 500 yards out, I saw the infantry in all the blocks pull arrows out of their quivers at their sides. Tower after tower of them, as far as I could see. Then I heard the strain of the composite bows as they drew them back, bows titled up, not aiming towards targets, but intending to hit the area the deserters were marching into at the extreme edge of their range. As the deserters came a few strides closer, I heard officers call out, "Loose!" And it was nearly one voice, as 100,000 arrows filled the sky, their dark shafts thicker than rain, blackening the blue, and the sound of their flight like a storm wind. Thousands struck the earth in front of the deserter line, tens of thousands maybe, but the majority slammed into the giant wooden rectangles thicker than any human shield. And while the deserter line had suddenly sprouted over 50,000 shafts, the wooden barricade they held aloft and before them protected them completely. The Sildoon drew back and unleashed another volley, and another, but the deserter host kept coming, warriors and wielders both safe behind and under their makeshift portable palisade. Suddenly, the crossbow in my hand felt as useful as one of the inkwells in the writing case on my back. But that didn't stop the Sildoon from sending more volleys, and still more, until I heard Darzak scream,
"Hold, lads, hold!"
I thought he must have realized the futility of shooting still more arrows, but when I looked across the valley, I understood. The earth all around the deserter line had so many arrows sticking up, it looked like they were walking through thick reeds. But 20 or 30 yards in front of the line, the first rectangles of white were untouched. The earth and scrub that had been whitewashed were free of arrows. The ballistae on the wagons began launching their projectiles, and they arced much less than the arrows, slamming into the wooden face of the makeshift palisade wall the deserters had in front of them. The line suddenly slowed. I hoped it was because some of the spearheads had penetrated deep enough to damage the giants holding the panels, but more likely, it was because some of the shafts dipped and jammed into the earth. Gaps started to form in the line briefly, but the wielders ordered them to form up again, as the warriors holding the giant plank protection broke the shafts that had lodged in the earth, or dislodged them. Then they were moving forward again. And that's when I heard several loud thumps in quick succession. I looked to my left and saw the long arms of 10 trebuchets appearing above one of the hills just past the wing of cavalry, the slings empty and the huge round stones flying high through the air. These weren't the massive siege engines on top of the towers along the walls of Sunrak, but still large enough to drop stones half the size of barrels. The trebuchet teams were winching the arms back down even before the first huge projectile struck. Most of them hit the earth behind the deserter line, bouncing until they nearly struck the rooter wagons far behind them. 2 hit the ground before the line, bouncing high twice and then crashing into one of the front panels. But 2 hit several rows back, shattering arrow shafts, smashing the wooden panels underneath, and creating holes in the coverage. Commanders everywhere ordered the infantry to loose their arrows again, but while some inevitably made it through the gaps and injured deserters, they were quick to shift their line and close them up. Still, they recognized the danger the trebuchets posed, and the deserter line began to move faster. And that was when they hit the first patches of whitewashed ground 300 yards away. Suddenly, the cohesion of the front line broke completely, as several deserters disappeared, breaking through thatch mats that covered pits.
"Spikes!" Vindero called out. "Fall on them, you fuckers!"
He got his wish, as several deserters in the rows behind them carried into the pits as well, unable to slow their momentum in time. And that was far more devastating than some caltrops. Vindero whooped, and orders went up and down the line before the infantry resumed unleashing volleys of arrows that struck deserters by the hundreds or thousands, now that big sections of their wooden wall had disappeared into the pits and their line was broken. I heard a series of loud whumps off to the east as several of the trebuchets shot their large stones into the deserter host, again collapsing sections of the makeshift roof, creating more openings for arrows to rain down. 4 more trebuchet arms flew up as the counterweights dropped, but this time they shot what looked like large sacks high into the air. 40 or 50 arrows flew from behind the hill, many missing the mark, but several struck the sacks at the apex, and suddenly they erupted, pouring ash down on the deserters, and the sacks that hit the ground exploded into an ashy cloud as well. Reggie said, "It's not rain, but it's not half bad either." She punched me in the arm. "Looks like you gave them some good ideas. Having no eyes might do these huge bastards in before they even get to this side." The deserters closed the ranks again quickly, reforming lines as another volley of arrows flew across the valley. But it was obvious we'd done some damage, and now some of them might even be blinded or disoriented by the ash as they tried to navigate around the pits. It looked like Reggie was right. And that's when my flesh went pebbly with goosebumps as a chill washed over me. 100 yards ahead of us, a veil suddenly appeared, spreading in both directions until it covered the valley floor. The weft and weave of energy like a mystical tapestry unrolling. While it wasn't close enough to directly affect the Sildoon host, it did cut across the hill exactly where the trebuchets were, and I heard shouting carrying briefly from that direction, faint and warbled, before it was cut off completely. The infantry kept filling the sky with arrows, but they disappeared from sight when they passed through the veil, so there was no way to tell how much damage they did. A few moments later, thousands of projectiles flew out of the veil in our direction. I instinctively lifted my shield, as did the soldiers around us, and thought they had to be the stones launched from the staff slings, before realizing they were the gourds or clay canisters that released the thick, oily smoke when they struck the ground or shield faces in the Sildoon divisions. Being among the commander, Myrmidons, and Jackal officers, we were back far enough not to be hit directly. But the smoke wafted back towards us, and I heard the coughing rolling back with it as most of the Sildoon squares were lost from view. Even though I didn't endure the worst of it, my eyes immediately began to water and my throat burned, as this smoke, or gas, seemed even more potent than the kind the deserters had used when they captured us on the other side of the veil. I pulled the scarf over my nose, but even some distance from the most concentrated clouds, it didn't help a great deal. Another volley of canisters followed, smashing into the lines and releasing still more clouds of the noxious stuff among the Sildoon. The entire army wasn't affected. The deserters simply didn't have enough slingers to blanket the entire side of the valley with the smoke, but enough that the deluge of arrows suddenly cut off to a sprinkle, as most of the Sildoon were struggling to see or breathe. Tears were pouring from Commander Darzak's eyes as he yelled through his scarf,
"Sofjin, you've seen this. How long until it clears?"
She had her own scarf in place. Red, of course. "If they ever run out of ammunition, you mean? Several minutes, at least."
"Fall back,"
Darzak ordered. The doughy Myrmidon closed her red-rimmed eyes, and Sofjin didn't rebuke the commander this time.
A moment later, Doey said, "Let Vedica concurs. We fall back."
"Plaguing right we do," Commander Darzak barked the order, and a soldier next to him pulled his scarf down long enough to fix his lips to the end of a complex horn that curled around his shoulders. Then he blew and gave three short brassy blasts. I heard the same signal repeated up and down the line, and then we were all retreating, trying to put some distance between us and the canisters that continued to suddenly appear through the veil and drop out of the sky. Slaves broke down the horse pickets and led the beasts away, and the tower commanders and personal retinues followed, least affected by the smoke. We walked backwards, and I watched as the staggered lines of Sildoon came, many dragging their brethren along, trying to maintain order while shaking off the effects of the wafting blue-gray smoke. When we'd gone 30 or 40 yards up the gently inclining hill, the commanders ordered the trumpeteers to relay another order with two short blasts and the lines trying to reset. Tens of thousands of Sildoon still seemed to be struggling, maybe as many as half our host, even with the relatively cleaner air, but they were still hardened professionals. While they faced an enemy unlike anything they'd ever seen, decades of drilling and training seemed to break the engagement down to things they knew and understood. Even the ones who could barely see through their tears dropped their spears and shields on the earth again, took up their bows, and began knocking arrows. A moment later, another substantial volley arced through the air into the veil, and hopefully into the pale skin of the enemy on the other side. The next volley was heavier still as more Sildoon obeyed the command to loose. More clay canisters came our way by the hundreds, possibly the thousands, but the majority struck the ground we'd abandoned. And after a few more volleys, the canisters stopped coming altogether. Vinduro said,
"Think they're out?"
"Maybe," Reggie said. "Or up to something else?" The infantry kept shooting arrows by the tens of thousands, blocking out most of the sky each time, and I watched them disappear into the veil again and again, wondering what they were striking. Had the deserters made it past the series of pits? Surely their protection must have suffered to do so. The doughy Memurdon looked at Sofjin, then the commander, then back to Sofjin again, clearly uncertain about the protocol before announcing to both of them.
"Latvedica wants to strengthen our position, reclaim the war wagons and the ground we gave up."
She said this as a flat declaration, rather than a decisive order or even a question. I looked at the hazy smoke below us, thinner and dissipating, and saw the shadows of the war wagons, now unmanned. Darzak pulled his scarf down away from his mouth, face going crimson.
"We have no plaguing idea where the enemy is right now. Not a one. They could be retreating, they could be moving up into the hills. So unless the Grand Memurdon can squeeze her eyes real tight and make that go away," he pointed at the veil shimmering across the valley floor, "maybe we ought to hold the higher ground here and not fret so much about the godforsaken wagons until we get some real intelligence."
Sofjin started to reply when I heard shouting from several quarters and looked ahead. The deserters walked through the veil, undamaged by the shimmering warp and weft of memories that composed it. Their mobile palisade bristling with so many arrows, it was difficult to see the wood they were buried in. But no matter how many deserters had been caught in the pits, or struck by arrows or trebuchet stones, they had regrouped, reformed, and were now coming for us again.
"Will that suffice for reconnaissance?" Sofjin asked. "Order the advance, Commander. Now."
Darzak gave the trumpeter a brief nod, and he blew one long hanging note. And the jackals began surging forward, the lines mostly even as they moved at a quick march to reclaim their initial position. The second and third blocks of infantry behind, loosing arrows at our foes while waiting for the first divisions to advance. Everywhere around us, trumpets blew the same extended blast, and the Sildoon army moved forward as the deserters continued to emerge through the veil. Commander Darzak said,
200 wagons. Giving up good position for 200 plaguing wagons.
Makes no." He stopped as he saw what we all did. A volley of stones arcing towards us, released by deserter staff slingers.
The Sildoon did need a trumpet to tell them to halt and bring their embattled shields up, locking them edge to edge as thousands of stones larger than fists rained down. Most struck the squares of troops ahead of us, and I heard screams and shouts and curses from the jackals and the otters alongside them. While the stones weren't launched from a trebuchet, they still had more than enough weight and momentum to batter through any shields that didn't make it up in time to bear the weight with the rest. I saw one Sildoon bent over, fumbling to get his composite bow in his quiver while slipping his arm inside his shield, and a large stone turned the top part of his head to red mist. A few of the stones flew further, some landing near us, and one striking a jackal in the shoulder, crushing bone and likely knocking his arm from its socket. Vinduro and Rudgy pulled me under their shields. He said,
"Get your shield up there, Aki."
I did as he commanded, but the first barrage was over, and already the Sildoon were answering, volleys of arrows flying free. Looking down the incline, I saw the deserters had closed the gap considerably, and were nearly to the empty war wagons. They split around them, makeshift palisades still up, absorbing most of the arrows as they picked up speed, their huge legs churning. The front lines of the Sildoons formed their phalanxes, bows back in quiver cases, shields up, long spears angled over them, prepared to withstand the charge. While the squares behind kept shooting over them, but hitting very little but the wooden panels or the arrows already embedded in them.
"So much for not having plaguing shields," Vinduro muttered.
I thought about Muldus and Braelar and glanced over at the crossbow cavalry. They were still holding their posting, but shooting crossbows at the staff slingers who had fallen back behind the ranks of warriors holding the palisades. Dozens went down, bolts sticking out between the leather and brass armor. But that didn't stop another vicious volley from heading our way. Most were aimed at the infantry still wielding bows and came whistling in a nearly flat trajectory. All across the line, those blocks of archers didn't have time to duck or grab their shields and were struck down, bones crushed, helms stove in, sometimes two or three soldiers taken out by a single stone. I looked around my shield, just as the deserters closed in on the first line of Sildoon, sprinting now. I expected them to discard the wooden walls in favor of their weapons, but they kept the palisade ahead of them and charged. Spears struck the wood and shattered, and then the giants hit the phalanxes, smashing into the first line, the second, sending bodies flying as they used the huge panels like a ram and knocked soldiers into their brothers and sisters or trampled them under. I heard myself gasp, watching the ranks of Sildoon mowed down and battered out of the way, spears completely ineffectual, screaming, cursing, dying by the hundreds. The deserters smashed their way 10 men deep in each square, 20 into the next square, and then started laying about with the huge palisade pieces, swatting Sildoon in all directions, annihilating the integrity of the lines and formations, bellowing inexplicable war cries or simply expulsions of rage as they did. The squares behind loosed as best they could, but they were down to their final sheaves now, and while they eventually took deserters out, it was only after each one had killed dozens of Sildoon and broken the ranks to pieces. The giants waded into the huge gaps in the lines, most of these with their great clubs out now, spikes bloody as they wreaked havoc, smashing and puncturing bodies on all sides. Deserters that stopped to swing the palisades or switch to their clubs were struck by arrows or stabbed with spears and eventually fell, but only after devastating even more of the Sildoon ranks. And the arrows seemed to be nearly exhausted now. While the heavily armored archer phalanxes might have been a tremendous formation against nearly any other foe in the world, the giant deserters had outwitted them. And everywhere I looked, the lines were fractured and buckling, in disarray, with thousands of deserters still ramming their way through the tight ranks of men, palisade pieces obliterating anything that stood in their path. And while the Sildoon might have been able to quickly maneuver against any human army, pivoting and bringing those thousands of spear points to bear, once the deserters blasted through the first ranks, the weapons were nearly useless. To our right, a deserter made it through the first squares of infantry and kept on going, charging towards the otter commander and his household guard. The Sildoon formed up quickly, wielding melee weapons and shields. I thought they would all be trampled and destroyed,
but a Memurdon stepped out of the retinue, held her hands aloft, and then attacked exactly as Sofjian must have instructed, bombarding the giant with human memories. He slowed,